Hello, and welcome to A History of Japan. Season 3, Episode 8, A Brief History of Buddhism. Like many young Americans, I remember being told many times throughout the course of my childhood education that Buddhism is more of a philosophy than a religion. I'd like to stress first and foremost that this idea is misleading at best and verges on being completely false. While it is true that Buddhism is certainly animated by a core philosophy and that its practice varies dramatically throughout the world, I believe it is best understood as a religious phenomenon. While there are some schools of Buddhism which promote a less mystical and more secular and pragmatic approach to the way of the Buddha, those schools are in the minority, and similar secularized approaches can be found for other religions as well, like deism in Christianity, for example. While it varies greatly from place to place, under the vast umbrella of Buddhism you can find theology, scriptural commentary and criticism, theodicy, eschatology, and many other elements which are generally described using such $10 words. Certainly the form of Buddhism which first came to Japan was absolutely understood as a religion, albeit a different kind of religion than the Japanese were accustomed to. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Our story begins in an area corresponding roughly to modern-day Nepal in the 500s BCE. Many things have been written about the founder of Buddhism, but we have yet to discover direct sources from the time when he lived. The earliest texts which we have access to date to a few centuries after his death, so it's safe to assume a certain amount of folklore in the story of his origin. That being said, there does seem to have been a concerted effort on the part of Buddha's disciples to accurately recall his teachings after he died. The man who would become known as the Buddha was originally Siddhartha Gautama, who was born into an aristocratic family and wanted for nothing, growing up sheltered from the harsh realities of the world around him. As a young man, he ventured alone from his family's palace compound into the city of Kapilavastu. What he saw there shocked and scandalized him beyond measure. People starving in the streets, disagreements erupting into violence, these were surprisingly horrifying sights to the young noble, and they shook him to his core. Thus, he began a quest to try and find a way in which suffering could be avoided and, ideally, eliminated. Before we go any further into this story, let's take a moment to understand some of the underlying assumptions he shared with the society around him. 200 years or so before he was born, the doctrine of reincarnation began to spread across the land. Initially intended as a comfort to the old and dying, reincarnation is the belief that one's soul is reborn into a new body after the former body dies. What kind of rebirth could believers expect? That was determined by a person's karma. The collective weight of someone's every action, both good and bad, would determine whether their rebirth resulted in a higher level of existence or lower. The term karma is widely misused in the West, and frankly, it drives me crazy. When a motorist speeds dangerously down the road and is subsequently given a ticket from a nearby traffic cop, that is not karma. That's just consequences. That motorist being reborn as a dung beetle in his next life is karma. The suffering we endure in our present lives, the sages of Siddhartha's time would say, is determined by the negative acts which we committed in our previous incarnation. While karma and reincarnation were initially optimistic and hopeful doctrines, by the 500s they were viewed with cynical despair. The ensuing disasters, unrest, and catastrophes of the previous 200 years meant that the concept of being reborn again and again, even with the benefit of good karma, was beginning to seem rather more of a threat than a promise. Thus, many sages began trying to conceive of a way to escape from the endless cycle of karmic rebirth, which is called samsara. Siddhartha Gautama is often referred to by his followers as Sakyamuni, which means sage of the Sakya clan, and I will refer to him as Sakyamuni from now on. Sakyamuni was so troubled by the pain, misery, and desperation he saw outside of his family's estate that he left his home to learn what he could from the respected religious teachers of his day. Among the family which he left behind was his wife and their child, but this was not some shameful act of abandonment for which Sakyamuni should be scorned. His wife and child were left in the care of his extended family, and we have no reason to believe that they lived in anything other than comfort for the rest of their lives. The communities which Sakyamuni was drawn to were the ascetic groups which lived in the woods and mountains outside of the cities, who made a practice of abstaining from both creature comforts and biological necessities, believing that their suffering would provide liberation from the karmic rebirth cycle. Practitioners would go for days without water and weeks without food. These sages likely experienced hallucinations because of these extreme practices, which no doubt encouraged them to continue. They believed that while there were many gods, there was one supreme source of life with which they could be reunited if they managed to escape the endless cycle of rebirth. Sakyamuni's experience in this practice was very negative, and he eventually came to the conclusion that suffering could not be eliminated by creating more suffering. Despairing that he would ever find a resolution to his quest, he withdrew to a place now called Bodh Gaya in eastern India and meditated in solitude beneath a fig tree, which later became known as the Bodhi tree. He swore a vow that he wouldn't rise from his seat until he had conceived an answer to the problem of human suffering. After 7 weeks, he is said to have experienced something very unique. First, he entered a state of existence known as nirvana, which means to be extinguished. This is understood as an extermination of his desires. Afterward, he claimed to have achieved awakening. The title of Buddha itself means awakened one. The answer to his question, the conclusion he reached after those long weeks sitting on leaves beneath a tree, was that humans suffer because of their desires and attachments. Wanting to share this blessing with the rest of the world, he recruited many of the similarly disillusioned young men whom he knew from their time learning from the ascetics together to serve as his disciples, and went about systematizing his method for achieving enlightenment. The system they conceived consists of the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. Using my own paraphrase, the Four Noble Truths are 1. Suffering is an inescapable part of life. 2. Desire is the origin of suffering. 3. There is a way to escape suffering. And 4. That escape route is to follow the Eightfold Path. So, what is the Eightfold Path? Essentially, it is a list of 8 activities and attitudes by which the practitioner could achieve extinguishment, which in Buddhist terminology is nirvana, and attain awakening and liberation from the otherwise endless cycle of rebirth. The items of the Eightfold Path, again paraphrased by me, are correct perspective, correct motivation, correct speech, correct livelihood, correct effort, correct mindfulness, and correct meditation. An 8-spoked wheel, called the Dharma wheel, is a common element in a lot of Buddhist-inspired art because it represents this eightfold path. After Sakyamuni's death, his disciples continued to spread his teachings, many adding their own flair to the eightfold path as they gathered followers on their own in the various places they traveled throughout the various republics and oligarchies of Nepal and northern India. How much of Buddhism's origin story is known for certain? It depends on how much you trust its transmission. What I've just presented is a combination of the most commonly agreed upon details of his life, mixed with the earliest stories taught about him, and I do think there is good reason to more or less trust the earliest sources. Sakyamuni taught for 45 years after his awakening until his death, which is a long time for his disciples to memorize his various parables and explanations. For possibly hundreds of years, the Buddha's words were passed down via this oral tradition, and the earliest written texts, known as the Pali Nikaya, were likely composed in the mid-300s BCE. How much faith you place in oral tradition will probably determine your own opinion on the matter, but suffice to say, I think we have reason to believe that the character of Buddhism likely didn't change too drastically between its initial inception and the later writing of texts. The early Buddhists built half-dome structures called stupas, which housed Sakyamuni's relics. This practice was likely a common way to honor teachers, usually ascetics, at the time, but it's clear that the followers of Sakyamuni believed that his teachings were of singular importance as they built 8 stupas in his honor throughout Nepal and northern India. The earliest Buddhists were largely of a monastic variety, but they formed a community called a sangha that included lay people who provided for the various material needs of the monks and nuns. In return for food, clothes, and other necessities, the monastic devotees would teach the lay people and guide them in proper Buddhist practice within the framework of the Eightfold Path. Various communities, referred to as schools, arose in that first century after Sakyamuni's passing, and some had different focuses than others. It was long alleged that the Buddha's most high-ranking disciples held a sort of church council a few months after his death, but such an event is strongly doubted. Another such gathering, referred to as the Second Buddhist Council, was assembled around 100 years after Sakyamuni's death. This was no simple meet and greet, however, but a prelude to a schism. The traditional account is that older members of the faith were upset by the lax discipline shown by the younger monks, who frequently violated monastery precepts without any accountability. Supposedly, some who had achieved the rank of arhat, which is one who has experienced the extinguishing of desire, nirvana, and thus escaped the karmic rebirth cycle of samsara when they die, were engaging in all sorts of activities that violated monastic vows. This conservative, vocal minority wanted to change the rules of the monastic communities, likely to put in place a more rigorous system of discipline. This change was rejected by the larger community, who nonetheless may have still condemned the errant monks. Unsatisfied with this, the more rigorous group broke away from the majority and founded the Sthaviras school of Buddhism, while the remaining members named themselves the Mahasamgika. The third reputed council was called around 250 BCE and had a rather important host, Emperor Ashoka, ruler of the Mauryan Empire, which at the time controlled a large portion of modern-day India. Ashoka himself converted to Buddhism after witnessing the mass violence and death of his expansion to the east, and the monasteries around the nation enjoyed his material support. Indeed, it is difficult for historians to accurately assess Emperor Ashoka because so much of the surviving Buddhist writing about him is so over the top with praise for his humility, piety, generosity, and other such features that it drowns out more neutral contemporary sources. Emperor Ashoka is usually credited with sponsoring Buddhist missions to Sri Lanka, southern Tibet, Kashmir, and the Greco-Bactrian Kingdom, which Alexander the Great had helped establish just west of India. It is also possible that there were already Buddhists and Jains living in the area when Alexander came a-conquering, but this is all unfortunately a bit murky. We can be certain that if Buddhism had not yet extended to this area, it almost certainly had by the mid-200s BCE. After the Mauryan Empire fell around 180 BCE, the Shunga Empire rose in its place. Unlike their predecessors, the Shunga followed Brahmanism, which is the precursor to modern Hinduism, and some stories claim that they persecuted the Buddhists in northern India and Nepal. There are many doubts about this alleged pogrom campaign, which some sources claim included a bounty for Buddhist heads, but it is almost certain that the monasteries in former Mauryan territory would no longer enjoy the state support which they had come to rely upon, and that they would also have lost political influence. The Greco-Bactrians invaded and annexed parts of western India at this point, possibly under the pretense of protecting their fellow Buddhists from Shunga persecution. Starting in 180 BCE, the Greco-Bactrian kingdom becomes labeled by historians as the Indo-Greek kingdom. Over the course of the Indo-Greek kingdom's existence, many threats would emerge, first on their western border, and gradually they lost ground to the Seleucid Empire, the Central Asian nomads known as the Yuezhi, and to the Indo-Scythians. Before their time in history was over, however, the Indo-Greeks sponsored many Buddhist missions which reached as far west as Asia Minor and possibly even Greece. Through their contact with the Han Dynasty via the Silk Road, their incredibly beautiful and unique statues of Buddha have been preserved in spite of their kingdom's collapse. And it is likely that An Shigao, a Buddhist missionary from Parthia who traveled to China around 147 CE, probably became a Buddhist in the first place thanks to the Indo-Greek influence from long before he was born. That brings us to the most famous divide in Buddhism, and one which my Western listeners might have even heard of, the split between Theravada and Mahayana. What famous incident, council, or controversy birthed this schism? Unfortunately, we don't know. We know the areas upon which the two sides disagree, but we don't have firm records of when that separation actually occurred. The best we can do is say that the Mahayana emerged sometime between 100 BCE and 100 CE, which is a 200-year spread. Far from being some obscure difference in doctrine, the split between Mahayana and Theravada comes down to the question of the larger point of Buddhism itself. The Theravada are among the more conservative of the two groups and sought to become arhats by attaining awakening and thus being released from the cycle of rebirth. The Mahayana group, however, came to view this objective as a selfish endeavor, which, once accomplished, impoverished the larger community of adherents. They proposed that pious practitioners should instead seek to become a bodhisattva, which is a person who is on the path to becoming a Buddha, but has not yet accomplished that goal. Thus, a bodhisattva is reborn and can continue helping the larger community so that more people can attain enlightenment. Mahayana also took on a much more traditional religious flair than Theravada through the idea that, in addition to Sakyamuni and other Buddhas before him, there was also a sort of deity Buddha known as Amitabha, or Amida Buddha. Often referred to as the Cosmic Buddha, he comes with his own backstory, being a king in his former life who renounced his throne and, in addition to attaining Buddhahood, also managed to accumulate enough merit to become a powerful god after his death. He used this power to create a realm called Buddhaksetra, an afterlife paradise meant for the souls of Buddhas once they achieve nirvana and enlightenment. members of the Mahayana movement produced many additional sutras, which they saw as having the same legitimacy as the Pali canon. Of these works, the Lotus Sutra would eventually gain a tremendous following and remains influential in Japanese Buddhism to this day. By the end of the 1st century CE, Mahayana had emerged, but was isolated to a stark minority of Buddhist followers. Though small in number, the Mahayana would eventually grow to become a major force both within Buddhism and throughout East Asia. Around the 3rd century in northern India, yet another major school was founded which, like Mahayana, endures to this day. This is the Vajrayana school of Buddhism, and while it is similar to Mahayana, and indeed may have originated from that growing movement, its proponents employed very different tactics. While Mahayana focuses on prescribed paths to attain enlightenment, Vajrayana starts from the premise that human minds are inherently enlightened, and that by nurturing that existing enlightenment, they can remove desire and attachment from their lives. While Theravada Buddhism would eventually spread throughout Southeast Asia and remains the dominant strain in modern-day nations like Thailand, Laos, and Cambodia, it was Mahayana Buddhists who established communities throughout China in the 400 CE. While the earliest known Buddhist contact with China was around the middle of the 100 CE, it remained largely a niche religion which blended with Taoism and Confucianism. It is in China where we see the strength of Buddhism's flexibility. You may have noticed that outside of the cosmic Buddha Amitabha in the Mahayana sect, Buddhism doesn't have much of an inherent pantheon. In some places, this meant syncretism with local beliefs, and in others it meant outright competition. In many parts of China, this meant that Buddhists often adapted bits of Taoism and other indigenous beliefs, performing magical rituals and divination, alongside the usual following of the Eightfold Path. Ancient China was a vast land with many different peoples, customs, beliefs, cultures and expectations, and in the 400s, political power had decentralized during the Northern and Southern Dynasties period, which, as I mentioned in a previous episode, led to a greater interest in Buddhism partly because of its focus on individual suffering. This brings us to a fundamental difference between religions in the East. Some, like Buddhism, focus on the individual practitioner, who follows its precepts for self-improvement. We can call these individual religions. Many of the indigenous religions of China, Korea, and Japan, however, were focused on the prosperity of the entire community. The Yamato king did not perform a given cleansing ritual solely out of a sense of personal piety, but because that ritual was meant to benefit everyone. Understanding this can help illuminate why conflict sometimes erupted where Buddhism spread. It was a remarkably different way of approaching the spiritual world, which left some wondering whether the local deities might not become offended that they were no longer being honored. After all, when regional gods get offended, they tend to get smitey. The form of Buddhism which came to Japan in 552 CE had the spiritual essence of Mahayana, various magic and divination rituals borrowed from traditional Chinese influence, and the structure of a state-sponsored religion. The foundations of Buddhism in Japan are not a simple matter of monks coming to teach and immediately finding themselves welcomed and given royal support. While it would eventually be established as part of the national religion, its acceptance was by no means a foregone conclusion, because the established religious authorities in the nation, that is, the Nakatomi and Inbei clans, eyed this foreign practice with suspicion and distrust. While at first the Soga clan's acceptance of an idol and a few sutras may have seemed like a trivial event, a few ill-timed catastrophes soon convinced the more conservative clans that this new devilry was a threat not only to their job security, but also to the stability of their communities. Next time, we'll learn all about the disasters that ensued after the Soga placed Buddhist relics in their family temple and the aftermath of Japan's first religious war. Until then, you can follow the podcast on Twitter at @ahistoryofjapan. Visit the online store, ahistoryofjapan.threadless.com, and find us on the web, ahistoryofjapan.com.